So this is in the blurbs on the calendar. This is part two of Did Humans Fall or Were They Pushed? And in some ways, it's really part three because we touched on some of this stuff about 4 weeks ago. And I said then that I would come back to this for a more thorough exploration. So that's what this past week and this morning are delving into, and there'll be a little bit more to come. When it comes to the dynamics of this community and multi-part explorations of anything, I realize that it can feel like you showed up and somebody started reading the story in the middle, which isn't a lot of fun. So there's three things that I've done to try to mitigate that, and I know that in some ways, you know, I'm preaching to the choir just now. I mean, we're the people that are in the room, right? But the first thing that I've done to try to help with that, so there's some continuity if people desire it, is that the podcasts are now up to date. Online, so I can meaningfully say, if you want to hear the other bits, go listen to the podcast. You can actually do that if you want to. And the second thing is that I've worked hard to try to have each of these explorations stand at least reasonably well on their own, so that it doesn't feel like we have to be here every week, or it doesn't feel like bait and switch. Yeah, you have to show up every week or you don't get the good stuff. That's not kind or fair, I don't think. Doesn't take a lot of things into account. And so I want each of these to stand reasonably well on their own. The third thing that I'll continue to do is I'll try to recap a little bit of the previous set of ideas to the degree that I feel like the overlap matters to our experience together here on a given morning. So a little bit of a recap first. Last week we explored some of the history of the doctrine of original sin. This is starting to sound too much like your Bible college class. If you ever had one, just relax. It feels important to me to do that part of the work when we're exploring what we believe for a couple of reasons. The first reason that I think that sort of work is important is so that we will all understand that doctrines, belief systems, structures, all of those kinds of things are not dictated by God. They are human constructs. They're things we make. They are important. They are powerful. They're deeply insightful. They matter a lot. They are human. And so they are subject to human frailties. And like many human ideas, they also need to respond to changing knowledge and to changing circumstances. To put it a different way, belief structures and systems and doctrines need to evolve, or they're going to become anachronisms. And anachronism is something that belongs to a period other than the one in which it exists. Can we all recognize in some of our beliefs something anachronistic every once in a while, where it's like, oh, yeah, that's clearly from not just another century, but another era, another epoch, maybe. I don't know how far back we're going to go with our math here. As people who have grown up in this era and culture, we are people who've grown up in a time that is deeply impacted by the person and the teachings of Christ. And we might not be conscious of that, but we if we stop and think about it, we actually know what this looks like. We can feel this in the push and shove of almost every conversation we have that has to do with culture change. Almost every conversation that we have in our cultural context about ethics or relationships or morality or justice, and we could keep going with that list, almost all of those conversations can be discerned to be significantly impacted by conventional Christian ideas and dogma. That's the idea stream that our culture still discernibly stands in. And so when we're having those kind of conversations, if we're paying attention, we can recognize in them the influence historically of Christianity. By the way, I am not trying to make a point about this being a good thing or a bad thing. It is so not that simple. It's just a fact. We live in a culture that is deeply influenced by this part of its history, sometimes in lovely and life-giving ways, sometimes in ways that are discernibly not good, sometimes in the messy middle ground. But the influence is there. Having said that, any way you slice it, we also live in a culture that is changing, often rapidly. We have information today that we didn't have yesterday. We have understandings today that we didn't have yesterday, never mind that weren't available to the people who wrote the things that have been compiled together into the document that we call the Bible. And unless we want to have our own spirituality become a misplaced artifact, an anachronism, a leftover from another time and place, we need to do the work of exploring what we believe and of evolving what we believe. And so that's why I think that historic work of where does this come from is important. So a bit about that history. We're still recapping just a tad. The idea that we arrive in the world tainted by what Christian dogma has called original sin, a condition about which we have no choice and which we cannot ultimately resolve, that idea is traceable to the writings of Augustine of Hippo in the 4th century, and in particular to his mistranslation of Romans 5:12, the idea that through one man, Adam, sin arrived for all of humanity, when in fact the original language would be far better translated that through one man, death arrived. We all die. We're mortal. Totally different story. Rather important mistranslation from, I would argue, a very influential and very morally distressed person. Augustine had lots to feel guilty about. His mother made sure that he knew. The upshot of Augustine's thinking on that matter is that we have got this doctrine of broken humanity as the starting point for who we are morally, and also as the dominant Christian explanation of the moral ambiguity that we all experience both within ourselves and in the world around us. I don't think there's an outstanding question here about whether we experience moral ambiguity, but we do. And if we don't think we do, then we just skipped our entire community time. We just checked out and went somewhere else or catching up to on our email or whatever. But there was plenty right there, and that's without any self-examination. This is just our human experience. And the most common or dominant Christian explanation of that experience has been original sin. We arrived this way and we can't do anything about it. As a bonus, we have had a legacy of guilt associated with human sexuality. If you want a fuller explanation of that, just that was last week. And we have the ongoing and substantial problem of women being understood as the shameful objects of male desire. Now, I said last week that I was offering an explanation of that that was sort of consciously skirting the reality of our culture as multigendered rather than two-gendered. If we want to translate this into our current cultural context, I think we could roughly translate that problem I just described into our ongoing inclination to excuse the perpetrators of sexual violence by assigning the moral responsibility to the victim. Full stop. So that's not a gendered statement. I don't care what gender or sexual expression generates that crisis. If we are visiting the moral guilt on the victim and the perpetrator's walking away, we are behaving one of the cultural implications, one of the cultural legacies of the doctrine of original sin. That's the argument I'm making. All right? I suspect that most of us would agree that these are problems. It's just that we might not have had the occasion or taken the time to connect the dots and to realize that the bad taste that we have in our mouth when we see yet another news item about the victim being blamed for the trauma and the perpetrator walking away, that we aren't just consciously thinking, oh yeah, that is connected to the need to have a plain conversation about the implications of this historic understanding of the human condition. Like, we actually have work to do around this idea, around this doctrine that is connected to that ick that we taste when we bump into that story, whether it's in the news or in our own life or however it happens. I said at the end of our time last week that this week I was going to explore some other possibilities for how that Genesis story might be understood, and I left us with this quote from Augustine. I didn't want to leave Augustine spinning in the wind as just this person who visited us with this doctrine that, you know, Augustine, you screwed everything up. Augustine wrote a lot of things, thought a lot of things, had a huge impact. It wasn't all about that. He, among other things, also wrote this: "Hope has two beautiful daughters. Their names are Anger and Courage. Anger at the way things are, and courage to see that they do not remain the way they are." My hope for this morning and for all our explorations here at the table is that they can move the conversation forward. That's what I dream about. And I dream about that happening within this community, and I dream about it happening beyond it, because I dream about us living of people of good courage who can contribute to needed change in the world. That can't happen without evolving belief, because the culture is not sitting still. So, finally, if you want, onto some other ways to look at this origin story in Genesis. The first task, when we do something like this, I think that the first task is the hardest. Because the first task when you try to do something like this is to try to set aside all the ways you've heard the story interpreted before. Rob Bell, I know some of you have read this book or are reading this book, has a new book called What is the Bible? And one of the interesting suggestions that Bell makes in that book is that we take the ideas that we already have and we think about them like a bunch of marbles. And when we want to try to come to a familiar document or a document that we've been exposed to a lot or heard taught a lot in certain ways, the first job is to actually take all our previous experiences and beliefs about it, think of them as self-contained objects, and put them somewhere to the side. Put all the marbles in a cup. That is enormously difficult to do. Because, especially if you grew up steeped in certain understandings of anything, this is not unique to the Bible or to Christian dogma, you grow up steeped in any particular set of ideas or mythology, and you try to step outside of it, you grind. Like, it's just super, super hard to do. Because what happens is that ideas get embedded in practice. And they get embedded in patterns, in ways of looking at the world and explaining things and thinking. And they become super potent shortcuts in our life. We have an experience. We encounter an idea. We find ourselves in a pit, as Jason reminded us this morning. And we want to know why. And the easiest way to answer a question like that is to go to the shortcut we already know. Oh, I know why this. I know why this is happening. It's because of the fall. Giant shortcut, right? But we do it. So taking all those marbles and setting them aside is really, really difficult. But it's worth the effort because this is what makes it possible for us to actually consider the possibility that we might not have this all sewed up, which is essential to evolving our own understanding and beliefs. So we don't do the first part. I'm going to suspend these things that I think I know. It's really hard to get to the next part. Don't have to throw them out. This is important. Don't have to put them on the pyre and burn them to ash to get moving on this. We might have that experience in due course. There's no way to say. But to get to part two, part one is that we just have to gather them, be conscious of them, set them to the side. So, having put our marbles in a cup, for a moment, try to imagine encountering the idea of original sin in the 21st century from the vantage point of someone that hasn't been influenced by Christian dogma. From that vantage point, that entire idea is utter nonsense. What do we know about human history? The species. Are we aware of any point in the history of humanity where there has been a golden age where everything was perfect? Where would that have been? In the history of humanity? Where in the timeline of the evolving species that we are would that have occurred? What our best take on the nature of humanity in the universe tells us now, this is important, now, is that we are an evolving species in an emerging universe. That's our best current shot at it. And if we step away from the dogma and we work from that starting point, one of the immediate implications is that Adam and Eve are literary archetypes. They're not real people. And the Garden of Eden, from that vantage point, didn't exist. And neither did the tree, or the forbidden fruit, or the talking snake. In the 21st century, reading the Genesis poem as a real historic event could be considered a serious disservice to a beautiful and a compelling text. And the reason I would say that is because reading it as a real historic event strips it of the possibility of serving us well now. Because it removes the story from the realm of myth. And we've talked about this over the last few weeks, and you might recall about a month or so we spent most of a morning talking a bit on what a myth is, but just in case you were on a camping trip, which is a great idea, here's a quick refresher. Myth could be defined as a universal and timeless story that reflects and shapes our lives. A timeless and universal story that reflects and shapes our lives. You could think of myths as behaving a little bit like parables or wisdom stories. They're stories that may still speak deeply and truthfully to the human condition, but only if we let them. And the simplest way to stop a myth from doing its job, from speaking to who we are and how we need to change and how the world is, the simplest way to stop a myth from doing its job is to try to read them factually. Like, full stop. Myths don't do that. The reason that myths work is because they are about meaning, not about fact. That's why they work. So, generally speaking, to stay in this train just for a moment, no one cares if the events in a myth or a novel or a film or a poem actually occurred. That's not the point. Myths are meant to enrich rather than inform. They are an invitation to imagination. They're this warm welcome into the world of mystery and symbol and metaphor. And they can help us understand the human experience, for sure, but they are not set up to describe real events or things or people. And if we want them to misbehave badly, if we want to almost guarantee that we're going to misunderstand a myth, all we have to do is read it as fact. And things are going to go sideways right away. There is nothing exclusive about this to the history of our religion, of Christianity. Like, this is just about the way these things behave. So, if we can keep our literalist marbles in the cup just for a little bit longer, it might be possible for us to start to catch the playfulness of the Genesis story. Now, this might feel pretty foreign to us, especially if we grew up with this story being full of heaviness and the doom of humanity. But I think it's going to be worth the effort if we stay with it. Because if we stay with it, we can start to engage with this story for what it is. And this is really important, you guys. I did not grow up with this stuff. And I mean, man, I feel like I grew up in a lovely curiosity, especially from my dad's vantage point, or lovely curiosity-oriented experience of faith, where exploration was not a thing to fear, and where I didn't feel hammered over the head with literalism. I encountered it, for sure, and plenty of it, but I didn't have anybody saying to me at home, unless you think precisely this way theologically, you're doomed. That's been a rich legacy in my life. But I know that when you soak in a story under one ethos and then you come to it trying to look at it differently, it's hard. So, this might feel foreign. But if we stay with it, one of the things we'll realize about the Genesis story right away is that it's not a Christian story. It's a Hebrew story. This is not mysterious. This is a well-established fact about the nature of this tale. It's Hebrew. And one of the things that we will realize if we go down this path, and nobody encouraged me to go down this path when I was younger, so now it's a current challenge for me. But one of the things that goes with that is that if I realize that what I'm looking at when I read the Genesis story is that I'm looking at an ancient Hebrew text, and I start reading in the Hebrew tradition, the Jewish tradition, about how the Jewish people come to their own sacred text, which is what this is. It's not a Christian sacred text, it's a Hebrew sacred text that Christianity co-opted. The Hebrew people, when they come to their ancient stories, come at them with the given that there's room for play. There's room to be creative and imaginative with these texts. That's the way the Jewish tradition operates. There's this freedom to come at the text from lots of different vantage points. For example, I recently encountered a book by a contemporary rabbi that offers 6 different takes on the same biblical story. It's not an anthology. They're all by the same guy. Right? In this tradition, there's nothing unusual about this. One of my favorite writers, not a Jewish writer, but somebody who's really studied in this tradition, Robert Farrar Capon, calls this approach to sacred text holy horsing around, which I love. That's always just stuck in my head. It's like, yep. And what holy horsing around celebrates is that when we come to text as though it was not dogma, as though it was myth, as though it was lively, life-opening story, when we come with that vantage point, one of the things that happens is our imagination can wake up. And we can start to think differently, not just about the story, yes, about the story, but about everything around us. So the story can help to open our body, mind, spirit, our whole life to other understandings and other ways of looking at things, which we need. Anybody here who's ever tried to step into another cultural space, whether it's the space that their neighbor lives in or the space that, whether you're traveling and you have that experience, however you experience it, you know that to do this, we have to be able to try to see, feel, think, act from a different point of view. It's a rich thing. It's not an easy thing. Holy horsing around. If we stand back from what we think we know about what the Genesis story means, one of the readings that easily surfaces for this story is that it's satire. That in the best sense of the word, it's a joke. And I tried to frame that as carefully as I could, because when we say something's a joke in our culture, that's an idiom that we use to be dismissive, right? Ah, are you joking? Like, you're not serious. This isn't real. That's not what I mean. Which is why I use the word satire. This is a very deliberate kind of story. It's meant to get our attention. But if we can stand back from it a little bit, then I think one of the things that can happen is that we can start to imagine the writer writing the Genesis story with a twinkle in their eyes instead of with tears in their eyes. This is that big a reach, I think. And if we read it that way, this whole story about the commandment from God not to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is a setup. Right? Jeremy's tracking. It's like saying, don't imagine a pink elephant. Don't imagine a pink elephant. Don't do it. Don't imagine a pink elephant. No one in the room, imagine a pink elephant. Like, the more you hammer this over the head, the harder it gets to not imagine a pink elephant, right? What happens? Don't imagine a pink elephant. Most of us start to picture a pink elephant, right? This is reverse psychology, whatever you want to call it. This is what happens. Don't touch that. It's hot. Don't do that. It's forbidden. Don't eat that. It'll blow your mind. Of course Eve's going to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Right? Don't eat it. Don't eat it. Don't eat it. Can you hear the crowd? Can you hear them chanting? It's like going to see the Rocky Horror Picture Show or something. Anyways, don't eat from the fruit. Don't eat from the tree. Don't eat from the... It's all through the story. Don't eat from the tree. Don't eat from the tree. Don't eat from the tree. Don't eat from the... Of course she's going to eat from the tree. It's a perspective thing. From the perspective of this kind of reading of the story, eating the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is not an act of iniquity. It's an act of courage and liberation. I can hear the marbles rattling around trying to get out of the cup. Hang in there. Remember, we're exploring, so in our context here at the table, if this shoe doesn't fit, don't put it on. But stay inside the world of imagination for a minute. Remember, we're in a story/poem. We are not in a history report when we read this story. This is poetics. So, inside the world of this story, what would have happened to the human species if Eve had not eaten the fruit? This is like one of those pick-your-own-ending novels, you know, if, then, you know, it's like that. What would have happened to us as a species if Eve had said no? And Adam, I don't think it's a good idea for you either. Well, one of the distinct possibilities is that we, humans, would have remained in a moral state that was a lot like the other animals in the story. We would have remained driven, morally speaking, by ethically neutral impulses. We would have stayed like all the other creatures, morally. The knowledge of good and evil, folks, is what makes us human beings. Arguably, without moral knowledge, we would not be human. And when you look at it this way, the Genesis story isn't about paradise lost. It's about paradise outgrown. And it's not about original sin, but it is about the birth of conscience. Try this. The next time you hold a little one, take a moment to imagine them arriving in the world in a state of grace instead of under a curse. Try to imagine them arriving here blessed by God, breathed into life by divine spirit, and loved by God absolutely unconditionally. And then ask yourself, what inspires me more to become a whole person? Grace and love or guilt? What if from the beginning of the story, we nurture in our little ones a consciousness of God's unconditional love that will never, ever let them go? What if we do that? What if that's chapter one? All right, Tim. So that's playful, maybe even kind of intriguing, but how are you going to explain the displays of self-will, even defiance, that we witness from our own little people, perhaps even this morning, right here at the table? And if that's not a sufficiently compelling problem, how about all the ways we grow up and screw up? Isn't that evidence of original sin? Well, that's a good question, and I'm glad I asked it, because it's the perfect setup for the next part of this exploration. I'm going to leave us with one idea and with a detail. Idea first. Question, really. What if our moral complexity and ambiguity are part of a bigger picture of how we humans have evolved over millions of years? What if our moral ambiguity and complexity are part of the story of how we have become moral creatures? What happens to the way that we think and act if we consider that we are the bearers of the knowledge of good and evil, but we don't always make the best choices? That's where we're going to pick this up next time. And the detail, as far as for my part and the talky bit in picking that up, it's not going to happen next week, but the week following, because we're off to Saskatoon next weekend as a family to spend some time with my mom and dad, and hopefully to offer a little bit more assistance with their transitions and with their health issues and some further aspects of their move, but mostly to be together as an extended family to just enjoy them while we can. Along the way, we'll pause to mark my dad's 80th birthday if he feels like he has the energy for it. I expect it'll be somewhat bittersweet, but I'm grateful we get to do it. Tim Penner is going to be helming the talky bit, which is something to look forward to, in my opinion. And then we'll, week after that, we'll return to some of those questions that I just left us with about our own evolving moral understanding as a species. You're a very patient bunch. Some of you are thinking so hard I can smell the smoke. You can let your marbles back out of the cup now if you want, as far as I'm concerned. But it's a good exercise. It's worth kind of going, yeah, what happens to my imagination about what I believe if I park the things I think I know for a minute and I tell the voices that are screaming at me, if you shift from this, you're going to hell. And I tell them just to shut up for a few minutes. Let me think for myself. Thank you very much. It's a good exercise. Thanks for being willing to be part of it. Peace.